In our Christian history of Africa, we come to Mary Slessor, missionary to Nigeria. Born 1848, lived until 1915, died in a field in Nigeria. Mary Slessor was born the second of seven children into a poor and troubled home in Scotland. And although her mother was deeply religious, her father was a violent drunkard who brought the family to abject poverty, fear and misery. If you thought David Livingstone was brought up in poverty, Mary Slessor was brought up in even worse poverty. David Livingstone at least had a father who loved the Lord and loved him and cared for him. But Mary didn't even have that. She's born and brought up in Aberdeen, as you can see up here in Scotland on the east coast. Scotland, a land that has provided many great missionaries, like Robert Moffat and David Livingstone. Their one-roomed home had no water, no lighting, no toilet, hardly any furniture. Mary slept on the floor, didn't even have a mattress they could pull out like David Livingstone had. Mary's older brother died, leaving her the oldest of the surviving children. When her father died, the burden of supporting a family fell upon her young shoulders. So at age 10, Mary began work as a half-timer, meaning she spent half her time at school and half her time at the mill. But when you talk about half-time, most of us would think that's actually full-time, because half-time for them was 7 hours a day. Few people today have more than an eight-hour day, and most don't work that much even while they're at work. But this was hard work, and again, the people walking around there to beat you if you don't work hard. So when she was 14 years old, she began working full-time, meaning a 58-hour week at the looms. But her mother ensured that she went to church every Sunday, the only day off that Sunday. Something else you might find interesting about the Scotland of that time, the only holidays the people had was the Lord's Day. There was no other holidays. You worked every day of the week, Monday to Saturday, full-time, and the only day off you had a Sunday. And you say, was there no holiday? Well, there was Christmas, there was Good Friday, and there was the Queen's birthday. That was about it, about three public holidays in a year. Mary was frightened into the kingdom of God by an old widow who warned her of the dangers of hellfire. Horror seized her, and she could not sleep until she came to repentance and faith. Some people say you should never use the dangers of hell to scare people into the kingdom. It may not be the best way. But many people have come to the Lord through teaching on eternal judgment. Mary became a tireless Sunday school teacher who gave herself completely to working in a mission to the slums around the church that she attended. And here you can see a memorial stone at the Belmont United Presbyterian Church of Scotland, where she ministered and worshipped. She served in Sunday school. Her mother's interest in missions and her memory of her older brother, who had become an outspoken supporter of missions and said he wanted to be a missionary to Calabar, which is southeastern Nigeria. And then the death of a younger brother, who had also been dedicated to being a missionary to Africa, led Mary to wonder, is it possible that she could take her brother's place? But at that time, single women in missions were unheard of. The only missionary woman who would go in the field would be a married woman. A single woman going into the mission field was completely thought of as impossible. But in 1874, a year after David Livingstone had died, the news came that he had died. It took a year for his friends and supporters who he had rescued from slave traders, Susie Schumer and Jacob Wainwright, to carry his body to the coast. It took a year for them to get his body to the coast. Many chiefs did not want to, all chiefs didn't want a dead body carried across their territory. There was tremendous superstition, fear. And so they had to often at night sneak across territory because they wouldn't have been allowed to otherwise. They had to conceal the body, had to fold them over double because a very long 6-foot pole would look like they're carrying a body. So they had to fold them over and make it look like a normal load. And they had to do a lot of this very secretly because if people knew they were carrying this man's body across. But they said, he's an important man. He must be buried with his people, but his heart belongs in Africa. So they buried his heart in Zambia, but his body was carried to the coast, and then he was taken to Westminster Abbey, where he is buried in great honour in the Cathedral of Britain. But a year after he died, in 1874, the news came David Livingstone has died. And this settled the matter for Mary Slessor. She determined, I must go to take the place of my brothers and follow the example of David Livingstone. So in 1876, Mary left home in Dundee for missionary training in Edinburgh. And the United Presbyterian Church appointed Mary as a missionary teacher. She was assigned to a mission station, Calabar, what today is Nigeria, right on the Cameroon border. It's the most southeastern part of Nigeria. The tribes among whom Mary was sent were animists, who worshipped the sky, the sun and the rain, and the spirits of the rocks and the rivers and the trees. And enslaving people of other tribes was an accepted and entrenched practice. Everyone saw it as normal. Mary was enthusiastic, and she is impatient, and she found the progress of work at the established mission stations far too slow. She ached for more demanding tasks, and she is reputed to have climbed every tree in the region. Frequent illnesses, attacks of fever, which almost took her life on several occasions, did not diminish her zeal for winning souls for Christ. And fortunately, she now had quinine tablets, Livingstone's rouser, to enable her to recover from malaria, which, of course, missionaries before had not had, but by then they'd come to realize David Livingstone was right. Mary maintained a cheerful faith. She was assigned to a mission station at the old town on the east bank of the Calabar River. It's right there on the border of Cameroon, in the Gulf of Calabar. The people in the area were utterly degraded. Amongst many things that horrified Mary was the practice of killing twins. When a woman gave birth to twins, she is regarded with horror. And the belief was the father of one of the infants must be an evil spirit, so to be safer, killed both of them. The mother must have been guilty of a great sin. She must have had intercourse with demons to have had twins. That was the belief. And so at least one of the children was believed to be a monster. So both twins were seized, their backs were broken, they were crushed into a calabash pot. They were taken out, not by the doorway, but by a hole broken in the back wall, which was built up again. They were thrown to the bush, where they were left to be eaten by insects or wild beasts. Mary's fierce, red-headed passion raged against this passion of the innocents. Now, Mary was a brave, brave girl. When she was ministering in the inner city in the slums of Dundee, the youth approached her, and one had a lead ball at the end of her string, swinging it around. And she stood firm. They walked up with the swinging until it literally grazed the bridge of her nose. And she didn't flinch. And they stopped and they felt convicted. And they said, she's all right. And they all joined the Sunday school. While Mary was desperately ill in 1883, a sister died in Scotland. Then she heard news of her mother's death, followed soon afterwards by death of another sister in Devon. Can you imagine? These were dark and difficult days for Mary. Home no longer existed. Her entire family had died. Father died, mother died, brothers had died, sisters had died. She was the last one of the family left. She threw herself even more wholeheartedly into serving her new adopted family in Calabar. For practicality, she cut her hair short. She abandoned all Western comforts and all Western food except for tea. Tea was her only luxury. It's a funny thing about these Scotsmen. Even David Livingstone considered tea a luxury. I mean, we would consider tea to be just normal. And she went around barefoot. Mary moved to Crete Town, where she began caring for many abandoned children. Here are two of the sets of twins she rescued, who she adopted. She is constantly interrupted by people coming to her for help. The sick needed treatment, the hungry needed food, and those with disputes sought her counsel to bring about resolution. Mary set up schools in Ekeng and Ifakwa, including this church that she physically helped build. Soon churches were built alongside the schoolhouses. They started with a school, went on to church. Amidst rampant witchcraft, drunkenness and immorality, Mary undertook much of the manual work, constructing the school and the church buildings herself, as well as daily tasks of education and evangelism. Mary served as a teacher and as a nurse, dispensing medicines, conducting four services every Sunday, walking many miles every day. Once when instructed to heal a dying chief, Mary knew she would be blamed if she failed, if he died. And this is what witch doctors often did. They would get the chief to pay all sorts of things, give all kinds of goats, and when he's about to die, they would send him along to the missionary hospital so he could die there, and then they'd blame the church. First she got rid of all the witchcraft charms and sacrificed chickens. Then she prayed and gave him good medicine and nursed him back to health. Now his wives were particularly grateful, as they would have otherwise been killed and buried with the chief if he had died. Because that was normal. When the chief died, his wives were buried with him because their usefulness is over. When the husband dies, many had this view. In the Pacific Islands, that was common. In India, they burned the widow on the funeral pyre of her husband. This is what happened before the gospel came. They were interested to learn about the book. A report of Mary's pioneer exploits in the Missionary Herald prompted a young Scottish carpenter, Charles Ovens, to come out to Africa to help her with the carpentry. His arrival was a great encouragement and practical help, but he had no confidence for preaching or teaching. He just dealt with the carpentry, but that was a help. In 1891, during her furlough in Scotland, Mary was courted by Charles Morrison and actually became engaged to be married. But when Mary realized that he was not willing to join her mission to Calabar, and her marriage would mean settling in Scotland and not returning to Africa, she broke off the engagement and returned to Africa. Now bear in mind, she was the only person left of her family. All of her brothers and sisters had died. She was the only one who could carry on the family. But she chose to adopt children that she had rescued in Calabar instead, and said no to marriage. At this point, the British government recognized that Mary Slessor enjoyed unparalleled trust from the local people, who called her Eko Koporo Owa, mother of all the people. And they appointed her as a consular agent. Later, she was promoted to being vice president of the Itu Native Court. All the public affairs of the Okurong were conducted through her. She presided over court cases, so she was effectively a magistrate and ensured that justice was served. Even though she's a missionary, this happened on occasion that missionaries were appointed magistrates. It happened to Samuel Marsden, who was the missionary to Australia, and he ended up being the magistrate as well, which makes you very unpopular because people don't like a lot of the decisions of the magistrate. And so you can imagine it's asking for trouble. But she was so concerned to bring justice to the people that she took it. On one occasion, as a woman was spread-eagled on the ground, staked into the ground, to have boiling oil poured onto her by the witch doctor, Mary boldly intervened. She physically interposed and prevented the witch doctor from harming his victim, standing over this girl and refusing to allow him to pour the boiling oil. The people were stunned at her courage. She confronted chiefs and witch doctors, and she survived. And here the witch doctors would obviously be putting curses on her, but they had no effect. They concluded it was the power of God that was protecting her. Mary was held in the highest regard by the local people, although the British government would not have approved if they'd known of the extent she went in the court cases. Mary never let legal technicalities get in the way of fairness. One plaintiff, while having a suit upheld against another, was punished for not treating his mother properly, for failing to maintain adequate hygiene, and for neglecting his farm. Mary was seldom free from illness. When the population moved, she moved with it. And in 1903, Mary had the joy of seeing the first seven young Christians baptized and the first communion service held. Imagine how many years she worked before seeing the fruit. Shortly afterwards, she moved to the Itu, which was notorious as a marketplace for slavery, where cannibalism was still practiced. Soon she had gathered a congregation of 300 and established a school of 68 principals. Mary Slessor also wrote back to her church saying, please send Maxim machine gun, because there's slave raiders in the area. And to protect people from the slave raiders, she wanted a Maxim machine gun sent out. Intriguing. Despite illness and discouragements, Mary was tireless in her hard work, and she pioneered mission stations, schools, and churches throughout Calabar. But fever and sickness constantly afflicted her until February 1915, when at the age of 66, she went to be with the Lord. Because of her efforts, many schools and churches had been established, the killing of twins had ended, slave trading in Calabar was eradicated, drunkenness, killing, and witchcraft was greatly diminished, and most of the people of Calabar, which is an Igbo land, southeastern Nigeria, came to embrace the gospel of Christ. Here's some of the great quotes you get from Mary Slessor. These were written in her Bible. God is never behind time. In other words, God is on time. If you play with temptation, do not expect God to deliver you. A gracious woman has gracious friendships. No gift of genius or position can keep us safe or free from sin. We must see and know Christ before we can teach. Have a vision of Christ before we can teach others. Good is good, but it's not enough. It must be God. It may be a good idea, but is it a God idea? Is what she's saying. The secret of all failure is disobedience. Sin is lost for time and eternity. Sin wastes time. Sin wastes money. Sin wastes opportunity. The smallest things are as absolutely necessary as the great things. Yeah, if we're faithful in small matters, God can trust us in large matters. An arm of flesh never brings power. Half the world's sorrow comes from the unwisdom of parents. This is so true. If we can be good parents, wise parents, bring up our children in love and a fear of the Lord, things will be better. Do you know, I've had policemen tell me, senior policemen, most of the gangsters, almost, in fact, I've had them say, all of the gangsters on the Cape Flats are from broken homes. Yeah. Single parent homes. They don't know who their father is, or their father they hate, or their father neglected them totally. Abused children often become criminals. Broken homes are the biggest cause of crime in our country. I mean, that's something to think about. And she is talking about that. Half the world's sorrow comes from the unwisdom of parents. Obedience brings health. Blessed the man and woman is able to serve cheerfully in the second rank. A big test. You see, many people want to be chiefs, but we need servants. We need second in commands. We need aide-de-camps. We need assistants. You think like John Mark. John Mark was the assistant of his cousin Barnabas and of Paul and of Peter. But in time, because he had been a good second, he ended up doing a great work in Egypt, which is endured to this day. Slavery never pays. The slave is spoiled as the man, and the master is not less so spoiled. And, of course, she had to fight slavery because it was still continuing amongst tribes in that part of Calabar. It were worthwhile to die if thereby a soul could be born again. In other words, she's willing to give her life that others could be saved. Some good words. Daniel 12 verse 3 says, those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. One of many churches planted by Mary Celeste amongst the Etu people. Here's a memorial can for her. Here marks the site of the house. Mary Slessor, pioneer Scottish missionary, who died here 13th of January 1915. And her gravesite, plainly highly honoured in Nigeria. And the Queen of England came out to visit her mission house, where Mary Slessor had worked and run her school from. There's a road there, Mary Slessor Road. Churches that have been built in the area by converts of converts of converts. In loving memory of Mary Mitchell Slessor, born at Aberdeen, Scotland, 2nd of December, 1848, died at Calabar, Nigeria, 13th January, 1915, for 38 years, a heroic and devoted missionary, chiefly amongst the upriver tribes of this land. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that turn many to righteousness shall shine as the stars forever and ever. Now, this is a plaque in a church. Mary Slessor, born 1848, died 1915, mother of all the peoples, a missionary and a magistrate who lived in the Cow Gate and worked amongst the poor of Dundee from this building, the Weishaupt Church. George Weishaupt was one of the first of the Protestant martyrs in Scotland. In 1876, she joined the Christian mission in the Calabar region of southern Nigeria. She labored to spread her faith and to help others. Love suffers long and is kind. In Scotland, you can see money with Mary Slessor's image on it. Notice in the background her working on the loom, and on the back, a map of some of the mission stations she established and the place where she worked in Nigeria. quite good when you can have even a secular country publish stamps and money with a missionary's testimony on it. A victorious Christian who changed the world, one of the heroes and heroines of the faith. So any questions about Mary Slessor and Calabar, the mission to Calabar? Questions? Comments? You see here, this book has her signature on it too. Any questions or comments? They called her the barefoot missionary. And Servant to the Slave. Another interesting title of one of her books. Questions? Comments? Was Mary Slessor fairly well known before here? I'm looking. Is there a picture of Mary Slessor here in this hall? Is that not it? Yeah. There we go. I thought there was. And a chapter in the Grace Center of Missions book. So there's some good things to read. Right. Any other questions or comments? Yes. Very, very strong. Ibuland or Biafra. She works in the most southeastern corner. That is the stronghold of Christianity today. The whole of the area, Port Harcourt, that whole area. We've had, in fact, dozens of people come to our Great Commission camps and courses from that very area, from Port Harcourt. I was invited just a month ago up to Jos, northern Nigeria, but we've had a lot of people in Jos too, but Port Harcourt and this area where she works in Ibuland, very, very many come to our course in Campson, and they tell us of the great impact that she made. So the two great names in Nigeria, Samuel Ajayi Crowther and Mary Slessor. So, any other comments or questions? Yes.
Thank you. Apart from the activities that they got involved in, I'm talking about all the missionaries giving medical aid, building schools, do we have any kind of teaching that maybe they concentrated to teach, the kind of teaching that they really wanted to teach, apart from just meeting the needs socially of the African people, maybe by education and
food? That's true. We do. There are books, I mean, I think you've got some of these books in your library. You can read more on Mary Slessor and what she taught and did. It was very into teaching. You know, in many cases you look at this and you think, a young woman, a single woman, why was she there? Were there no men who could have come and done the work? And she only got one person to come and help her out at the work, and he just helped with carpentry and was a blessing. But you wonder, where were the men? And but yes, there were excellent teaching. Most of them, we can see most of the missionaries, they started with the Ten Commandments. They taught the law of God. That's the first thing. They laid a good solid foundation with the law of God, the holiness of God, for people to understand the need of salvation. And then they would be teaching the Gospels. So the Ten Commandments always came first. The Gospels normally came second. From there, they would be going into the book of Acts and the Epistles of Church, and later they started to go back and build up all the Old Testament. Most did not work chronologically, starting with the Old Testament, Genesis, working through. Interesting how most missionaries seem to start with the Ten Commandments and then the Gospels. That was the first start. But only later did they go and lay the solid foundation of the Old Covenant to understand the full implications of the New Testament, and about the last thing they ever got to was Revelation. So of course the Bible determined what they were teaching. But I think all the missionaries I've studied in the 19th century, they began with the law, because the law of the Lord is perfect, it converts the soul. The law is the schoolmaster that leads us to Christ, that we can be justified by faith. So this was often their strategy. They administered the body, they administered the mind, so they'd start the clinic, they'd start the school. The last to be built is the church. It might be years down the road, because it might be 7-8 years before they get their first convert. They're starting with the clinic, meet people's immediate medical needs. They go on to school, they're teaching people how to read and write, and they often teach how to read and write using the scripture, often the gospels, and then from there, as converts come, they can set up the church, have communion, baptism, appoint deacons, build up the church, and so on. But you imagine if you go to a place and you're the first one, it's hard to start when there's nothing in terms of knowledge of God and the Creator and the gospel of Christ to start with. And of course they're dealing with, initially in that situation, 19th century, normally dealing with people holding to witchcraft or Islam, depending where the situation was. Any other questions, comments?
I want to ask to say that we are Christians. Now, these guys, they made an impact coming from the Western area to here in Africa. But if you can look at the gospel now, in that area, the gospel is not that sharp the way it was before. In fact, Africa is more balanced in terms of the gospel. So what effect is this thing creating in Africa? So how can we go back to evangelize in the Western area in order to bring them the gospel that they brought to us? What are the things, what are the measures to be taken in order to bring the Western to the gospel more and more?
Yeah, no. Good point. Really important. Today, there are 200 times more Christians in the Congo than there are in Belgium, which used to be the colonial power of Congo. There's 200 times more Christians in the Congo than there are in Belgium. And Britain, as we said, there's 18 times more Anglican Christians in Nigeria than there are in Great Britain practicing their faith, in terms of actually regularly. So, there's several things we can do. The first thing is, when you see NGOs, Europeans coming, whatever, maybe they're United Nations, World Health Organization, UNICEF, whatever, you know that most of them are pagan. Most are not Christians. And you can see it by the way they live, the way they speak, the way they get drunk, their morals, the way they speak. It's quite clear. I encourage the people in Sudan, for example, where we have done a lot of work, reach out to these people, witness them. I mean, don't be afraid of sharing the gospel with these people. These people are pagans. Who's going to give the gospel to them? They probably never even heard the gospel back where they came from, in Scotland or wherever they've come from. And I think many Africans are either intimidated or are very reticent to reach out to these, whether they are tourists, whether they are NGOs, whatever the reason is why they're coming through or to your country, but reach out to them just for starters. But then we've got to consider going there. Do you know some of the biggest churches in London today have Nigerian, Congolese or Angolan pastors? Now, but how about that? I've met some. It's quite extraordinary. So God is calling some people to take the gospel to Europe from Africa. I go to Europe fairly often. For example, in a month's time, less than a month, I will be ministering in France, England, Belgium, Holland, and Germany for the Reformation 500. And I find it so important to minister them. Now, we go there and we're reminding them of their heritage, because many people, even Wittenberger, huh? Luther? Why you take a picture of that? And they're a bit confused. Well, what happened in the Schlosskirche that you're coming here to commemorate? They live there and they don't even know their own history. And that's what I meant earlier when I said the stones cry out. Can they not see these great cathedrals built by people of a previous generation of a great faith? The stones are crying out. And these people are in many cases dull and insensible. So we need to share the gospel with them. And they are a hard mission field. They're so secular. They've been brainwashed. And you may say, how did the people of Europe lose their faith? Well, I can give it to you in a few words. World War I and World War II. And my parents were part of that. I went to the battlefront in Belgium, Ypres. Within 10-kilometer radius circle around Ypres, there are 156 British and Commonwealth, British Empire graveyards. In those graveyards, I went to just six graveyards, and I counted over 60 Hammonds, my family name, buried there. I went to the Commonwealth and British and Commonwealth War Graves Commission. They pulled up on the computer and they said, we have the details here of 480 Hammonds who died in the First World War. The destruction of so many young lives in 1914 was so destructive, so devastating, not just to the numbers of people killed, millions died. 11 million Europeans were killed in action in the First World War alone. Second World War is even worse. My mother endured 60 aerial bombardments, 1,000 bomber raids coming over Berlin, dropping all the bombs. My father in the British Army is experiencing his own things too. And my parents were so secular, they couldn't believe in God because of what they had seen in Europe. Europe was a Christian continent, and the Christians killed one another by the millions. Efficiently, brutally, with the most terrible gas, flamethrowers, mortars, artillery, aerial bombardments, submarines, everything you can imagine, until in the end they're using rockets. The destruction of so many lives in Europe destroyed European Christian civilization, basically. So the First and Second World War were designed by bankers, Freemasons, Illuminati people who hate Christ to get the Christians to destroy themselves, because at the First World Missions Conference in 1910, they saw that, in fact, the world was being ruled by Christians. In 1910, in the lifetime of Mary Slessor, the First World Missions Conference held, and as they looked at it, they said, present trends continuing, the Great Commission will be fulfilled by 1960. The whole world will be evangelized, evangelical and Protestant. There'll be no more false religions. Islam, Buddhism, and so on will be extinct by 1960. That's the year I was born. And that wasn't unreasonable. They weren't being unrealistic. Present trends continuing of the spectacular advances in the 19th century. By 1910, if present trends had continued, the world would be thoroughly evangelized. The Great Commission would be fulfilled. They were predicting the millennium before the end of the 20th century. Can you imagine? So what went wrong? 1914, the guns of August. When Christian Europe was tricked into killing one another in such a spectacular way. And Europe, before the First World War, 64% of the people went to church every Sunday. 64%. At the end of the First World War, 40% went to church every Sunday. At the end of the Second World War, 4% went to church every Sunday. The wars were so devastating, they destroyed generations, faith in any goodness of anything. And so people like my parents, now by God's grace, my parents did come to the Lord, but it took a long time. They were very resistant. I had to work for years and decades to see my parents come to the Lord. But because they were very closed, what they'd seen in Europe, you know, friends of theirs, vaporized, blown to pieces, limbs lying all over the place, their homes, suburbs destroyed. The destruction of Second World War was so intense that it destroyed the faith of most countries in Europe. So to go back to Europe now and to share the gospel with them is hard. But I've seen Europeans come to Christ, and there's some fine missions. Some of the brightest spots in Europe are African mission stations. Kwasi Kwabantu Mission, Reverend Olof Stegen, he's a German missionary, fourth generation South African, but from German background. His Kwasi Kwabantu Mission has got now schools and churches, mission stations in Germany, Switzerland, France, Belgium, Holland, Russia, Ukraine. Tremendous amounts of advance, but this has not been easy. But I go to communities now in Europe and find hundreds of people in a single congregation who love the Lord and dedicated. But hey, it's rough. So yes, we must go back to Europe. But remember, some of Europe comes here, either as tourists or NGOs. Most of them are pagan. Start with them. Share the gospel with all of them. Don't think that if you see a white person that he probably knows the gospel. Most white people do not know the gospel. Most of them are lost. They are into occult drunkenness. I mean, it's shocking to see the destruction of my generation. But I grew up in a family where I never heard the gospel. We never prayed. We never went to church, not even on Christmas. Nothing. Didn't matter what was happening. Nothing was prayed about. And I heard the gospel for the first time when I was 17. And that's me. And I'm, you know, now the older generation. There's a lot of young people today who never been affected by the gospel. The whites were once so well evangelized, so well discipled, and now they're one of the most lost people groups around. And the main reason is First and Second World War, followed up by Hollywood and secular humanist education, evolution. Does that answer your question? Good. Any other comments, questions? Yes.
Mostly, I see that only the elder people are the ones who are attending the service. So what is happening to the younger ones?
What is happening to the younger ones? Hollywood, nightclubs, drunkenness, drinking, immorality, gay parties, trans parties. Who knows what nonsense they're up to? It's shocking. I can't even relate to most of what's going on there. But pagan is anything. So it's a very shocking thing, because there was a time when, you know, you would have seen most of the white young people in this country, for those who are old enough, they were neat, well-dressed, clean-cut, respectful to their elders, respectful to women, standing up, giving a seat. I mean, I grew up with that. Even if we didn't know the Lord, we at least had some standards. But now, I mean, many of them look... They're about as demon-possessed and pagan as many of the savages that Henry Morton Stanley described. Tattoos, body piercing. I mean, many of them are walking around half-naked anyway, just like the people were before the gospel arrived. You think, you forget evolution. People getting better. There's devolution. People get worse and worse. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
Yeah, thank you for a good job that you're doing. But this question, I think it should be as one person asked about the missionaries who were in Africa, as we can see Dr. David Livingstone in there. And I can see you have a very, very tight schedule that you'll be going to England to France. And I want to know, we don't want to lose you. Are you mentoring somebody who is taking copy of you and who can be maybe sending him here next instead of you?
Thank you for that. I am trying. You may remember there's a young man who came here with me last year, John Clifford. Young chap. He is one I'm mentoring. There's my son-in-law, also Hunter, who I hope to bring here next year. Married to my oldest daughter. They now have a two-year-old, making me a grandfather for the first time. You see, I'm getting some grey hair. So, yes, I'm trying. We run these camps. Every January I'm running Great Commission courses. I have a missionary apprenticeship training program and a mission. I try to teach, but also, you can see I'm putting as much as possible in books, manuals, on the websites, sermon audio, making videos, even this recording system, are people asking me to please make DVDs of these presentations. So there's attempts for us to record as much. I'm trying to train people. And you notice when I go around the country, well, those of you who were here last year, that I came with a team. Now, at the moment, I've had to fly here because our mission vehicles are all in the field. And our team's up in Malawi and elsewhere. So I can't, I don't have a team to bring, because this year is the Reformation 500. And our teams are running Reformation 500 seminars and conferences all over, probably 15 countries in Africa. And I've got about 6 countries in Europe to hit this year. So this is part of our Reformation 500 year. which why I've turned up this time without any team that I'm trying to mentor with me. So on that sort of mission, I'd be going up for a month, driving around the country, going to different mission stations, Bible schools, churches, Christian schools, and ministering. And they would be learning along with me. And as we're driving, I'm discussing, asking, giving them assignments. I am trying to mentor others. But, of course, there's something unique about one's background. Like we were singing in the song, I Asked the Lord That I Might Grow, where John Newton gives his testimony. And I'm a product of war and military service and military parents and parents who survived the Second World War. And I'm a product of ministering in persecuted countries. And how do you replicate prison experiences? There's a lot of things that taught me to the point where I am. Now, I'm trying, but some people are more teachable than others. But some things are hard to teach. Character can only be developed by suffering and hard experiences. My young co-workers in the mission, they have vehicles, they have printing presses, they have literature, they have Bibles made. It's very easy. I had to walk and hitchhike almost everywhere. I slept many, many hundreds of nights out in the open. Nothing over me, not even a tent. I've slept in mud huts and thatched roofs and in trenches and in the bush and under thorn bushes and in parks and in sometimes in a garage, overnight hitchhiking around the place. Slept in the rain in the morning, get up, pull up the sleeping bags so all the water can run out, just soaked, everything soaked, and there was nothing covering. I don't replicate this for our workers. Now, we try on our Great Commission course to put a bit more stress on them and help train people. But, you know, it's not the same. As hardship is a very good discipleship tool. And we often try to bless and help our brethren and our children. But in so doing, we might protect them from things that God might use to shape them. So maybe we won't be developing people exactly like me, but I'm certainly trying to develop the doctrine, the interest in history, the knowledge. We try somewhat. Thank you.